Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll talk with Tim Gilmore, author of the book Box Broken Open, The Architecture of Ted Pappas.
It's remarkable that he's done as much contemporary design as he has, and that he's done as much historic restoration work as he has.
We'll discuss the history of the Equal Rights Amendment in Florida.
Florida considered ratification three times in 1972, 1974, and 1977, but failed to ratify the amendment.
And we'll talk about Coral Way Elementary in Miami-Dade County, the first public school in the country to have a dual-language immersion program starting in the 1960s. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. Architect Ted Pappas is known for his work on churches, including St. John the Divine Greek Orthodox Church and Restoration Catholic Church in Jacksonville, and St. Photios Greek Orthodox National Shrine in St. Augustine. He's also designed libraries, schools, office buildings, and more. In addition to creating new buildings, Pappas has done extensive historic restoration work. Studying architecture in the 1950s, one of Pappas' most significant influences was Frank Lloyd Wright. Tim Gilmore is author of the new book, Box Broken Open, The Architecture of Ted Pappas.
For Ted Pappas, Wright was such a huge influence, partly because of the phrase that gives the title to this book. Ted talks a lot about breaking the box open, which is a primary Wrightian kind of principle. The box being the structure, the architectural structure as it was traditionally designed. And he's always looking for ways to bend the geometry. It's really interesting to talk to him and hear how he talks about flow. A building is not a static thing. It's something that moves as you move through it. And, you know, he talks about how spaces open out into other spaces, how they move. And I think all of that originates with Frank Lloyd Wright. He also talks about a structure not being on its site, but of its site. That's a primary thing, you know, looking to the location itself to determine what should come from that location instead of what should be built on top of and dominate that location.
Ted Pappas was also influenced by Brutalism, an architectural style that became popular in the 1950s. It's a minimalist style that exposes bare concrete and structural elements rather than focusing on decorative design. Tim Gilmore.
If you look at a building like Ted Pappas's Singleton Center in the Springfield neighborhood just north of downtown in Jacksonville, you can see how Frank Lloyd Wright and brutalism come together. So the brute and brutalism is French for concrete, for raw. There's the rawness of concrete, which even walking through the Singleton Center with Ted, he talks about the flow of it. And you think of concrete as this massive, immovable thing, but you start to see it differently. You see how the whole building is built on this 30-60 grid, and there's no square corners in this building. And you see how it moves, and instead of being this heavy concrete thing like you think of most parking garages or something, the Singleton Center has this gracefulness of form and movement about it.
Pappas was also influenced by other mid-century modern styles, not the revival architecture that was very popular in Florida.
inevitably you see Le Corbusier international style that really broke away from tradition, from the neoclassical that was happening. And at the turn of the 20th century, there were all of these so-called revival styles of architecture, whether it was things called colonial revival or Mediterranean revival, especially in Florida, or Gothic revival. And there were just a million revivals. So I think with Le Corbusier, you had cantilevers, which also Frank Lloyd Wright was doing very different things with. And Pappas's Hogan's Creek Tower looks very Corbusian, to use that adjective.
Although Ted Pappas favors modern styles of architecture, he often unites ancient tradition with contemporary vision. His first solo commission was St. John the Divine Greek Orthodox Church.
That was built on Atlantic Boulevard in Jacksonville. And you can see, you know, the cantilevers, and you can see the use of concrete, but he's also using, in a new form, columns that he sees going back to ancient Greek temples. He's using barrel vaults that he sees in lots of ancient Roman architecture. He looks forward, but always, I think, with a deep sense of tradition. And I think that's something that is innate in his work.
In addition to creating innovative new buildings like St. John the Divine and the Singleton Center, Ted Pappas has repurposed or rehabilitated historic structures throughout Jacksonville, including the oldest historically black college in Florida, the city's oldest library, the oldest private club building, the oldest high school building, and the oldest church structure. Tim Gilmore.
If Ted Pappas only had done contemporary work, the work that he's done would be an incredible accomplishment in and of itself. And if he had only done historic restoration, that work that he's done would have made for an incredible career. And he's done both. That includes work on the old San Jose Hotel, which became the Bulls School in Jacksonville, Epping Forest Historical Mansion of the DuPonts in Jacksonville. And when you're downtown, you really could throw a baseball from one of his historic restoration projects to another. And that includes the old St. Andrew's Church, which is one of the oldest structures downtown because it was not destroyed by the Great Fire of 1901, built in the 1880s, and now home to the Jacksonville Historical Society. Duval High School, so the first high school building, the oldest high school building that survives in Jacksonville, which is now housing. The Jacksonville Free Public Library, this is one of the Carnegie libraries and is now home to a law firm. The Seminole Club, which was a club where politicos and prominent people met back in the day and is now a restaurant. And there are so many structures. He's worked on Edward Waters College historic structures. So Edward Waters being the oldest historically black college in Florida. It's remarkable that he's done as much contemporary design as he has and that he's done as much historic restoration work as he has.
Tim Gilmore says that despite Ted Pappas' success, he has experienced some heartbreak as an architect. For example, the restored and reimagined structure that served as Pappas' headquarters was destroyed.
Really, it combined both of the impulses throughout his career and working on a historic space, but also doing something that was brilliant and new with it. And when Riverside Avenue was widened, when the state decided that they needed to widen Riverside Avenue, then that building was demolished. And he had to see this thing that was, his headquarters, but also such a big piece of his heart, destroyed in front of him. Now, the state talks about redoing Riverside Avenue again and narrowing it, which is really frustrating, you know? So that kind of heartbreak, you know, walking into some of the libraries that he's designed in Jacksonville. And when you walk in with him, he can point out all of the things that were part of the vision. And he can also talk about those parts of the vision that aren't there anymore because city and state institutions don't necessarily carry the artistic vision forward.
Tim Gilmore with Mark Pappas is author of the new book, Box Broken Open, The Architecture of Ted Pappas.
It's a Holy Ghost building, it's a Holy Ghost building,
hallelujah,
it's a Holy Ghost building for my Lord, for my Lord.
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Registration is now open for the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Florida State Genealogical Society Conference, being held May 18th through 20th in Lakeland. Just go to myfloridahistory.org for more information and to register. Amy Anderson from the La Florida Interactive Digital Archive of the Americas will be the keynote speaker. Other engaging presenters include Bob Keeling, author of the new book, Good Day Sunshine State, How the Beatles Rocked Florida, Gary Mormino, author of the new book, Dreams in the New Century, Instant Cities, Shattered Hopes, and Florida's Turning Point, Alonzo Felder, author of the book, Discovering A.S.J. Allen, A Story of Skinfolk, Kinfolk, and Village Folk, and many others. There will be tours of the Frank Lloyd Wright architecture at Florida Southern College, visits to several local museums and archives, special musical performances, and much more. That's the Florida Historical Society Public History Forum and the Florida State Genealogical Society Conference, May 18th through 20th in Lakeland. Registration is now open at myfloridahistory.org.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Kimberly Wilmot Voss, a professor of journalism at the University of Central Florida, is well known to many members of the Florida Historical Society and readers of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Her research focuses on women in journalism and reporting on women's issues.
In a 2009 article in the Quarterly, Voss looks at the media reporting of the several efforts by the Florida State Legislature to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. As she states, the study examines the fight leading up to the 1977 defeat of the measure by looking at the media's coverage of the ERA battles, women versus women themes, and Senator Lori Wilson's mediated representation. The Equal Rights Amendment has a long history. First introduced in both houses of Congress in 1923, it was conceived by Alice Paul. A Quaker, suffragist, and leader of the National Women's Party, she was identified as more radical than many of her fellow suffragists, as she adopted the actions of British suffragettes and organized suffrage parades and picketing before the White House in support of the vote for women. Efforts to bring the ERA before the states for ratification were unsuccessful until 1972, when Congress enacted legislation for the amendment. In quick succession, a number of states ratified the amendment, which stated, quote, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex, end quote. Two additional sections gave Congress the power to enforce appropriate legislation supporting the amendment and indicated that the amendment would take effect 2 years after the date of ratification. Florida considered ratification three times in 1972, 1974, and 1977, but failed to ratify the amendment. The ERA inaction mimicked earlier consideration of women's rights. In 1920, Florida did not bring the 19th Amendment for Woman Suffrage before the legislature for ratification, although several cities already allowed women to vote in local elections. In 1969, the legislature symbolically ratified the 19th Amendment. Voss places her work within the context of previous studies on Florida, the South, and the ERA, but distinguishes her research by focusing on the media in reporting the events and determining the outcomes. By focusing attention on a pivotal figure and casting the battles between women as catfights, she says, the media lost the opportunity to engage in the larger role of explaining the impact of the ERA and facilitating broader public discussion.
The consideration of the ERA was a time for serious discussion. Labeling it as a catfight seems unnecessarily derogatory.
It does. As with so many aspects of efforts to ratify the ERA, and similar to the push for the 19th Amendment in 1920, labeling the debates between pro- and anti-ERA groups as catfights robbed the moment of its policy importance and relegated it to the realm of screeching noise with few historical implications. The ERA mattered to women on both sides of the issues, nor was either side entirely unified in its support or opposition. In addition, both sides argued over the methods to be used in the fight. On the pro-ERA side, divisions between the so-called old guard and new guard, that is, women in professional roles who had been involved in earlier feminist fights, and those new to the fight who often arrived through civil rights, stymied the creation of a unified voice for ERA advocates. Some leaders, such as Betty Friedan, were portrayed as divisive and too removed from typical women to represent their views. They agreed, however, that a constitutional amendment was needed to move women from the status of second-class citizens. In many states, women could not own land, obtain a mortgage, or obtain credit in their own name. Until 1968, a Florida woman who wanted to go into business on her own had to petition the court to demonstrate her competence and good character. More unified in their opposition, the anti-ERA arguments focused on concerns that ratification of the amendment would lead to unisex bathrooms, the elimination of alimony, and the legalization of gay marriage. Voss notes that the two reasons most cited for opposition to the ERA were conscription of women into the military service and the breakdown of the family. Citing other studies, Voss notes that in the South, feminism competed for space within the public rhetoric still struggling with issues of race. As an example, she points to claims of anti-family lodged against ERA supporters who advocated government-supported daycare. Opponents claimed the centers created by the ERA would take children away from their families, just as busing had literally taken children away from their families in the process of desegregation.
Connie, how did the media depict these differences and influence the outcome of the ratification?
Voss argues that the language used by the media was condescending and negative. As an example, the women's strike for equality on August 26, 1970, was the largest women's protest in American history to that point. But media coverage focused on throwaway quips by men. Vice President Spiro Agnew noted that three things have been difficult to tame: the oceans, fools, and women. We may soon be able to tame the ocean, but fools and women will take a little longer. On the national level, not all ERA proponents saw the media as unsupportive. Activist Susan Brown Miller, historian Carol Mueller, and journalist David Broder point to the role newspapers and magazines played in highlighting the issues and unifying the forces of ratification. Voss points to the media failure to provide analysis of the amendment and questions the claims by each side as contributing to the state's failure to ratify the ERA. While most newspapers focused on the catfight that erupted between the opposing sides, polls indicated that Floridians supported ratifications by a wide margin. Political figures who claimed that the people of Florida don't want the ERA to pass were not challenged. On the editorial pages, letters for and against ratification were paired, giving the impression that support for the amendment was weaker than the polls indicated. Both the Miami Herald and the St. Petersburg Times championed the ERA, but even there, the support was framed by male journalists, since women played a limited role in the creation of mainstream media messages. In addition to shaping the rhetoric, media focused on personalities rather than messages. The emergence of Gloria Steinem and Phyllis Schlafly provided media with national figures who were articulate and photogenic. In Florida, that role was played by Brevard Senator Lori Wilson. Elected as an independent, she emerged as the sponsor and principal advocate of the ERA in Florida. In a speech before the Senate on April the 10th, 1974, she tied ratification of the ERA to the nation's history of liberty, but did not move the legislature to ratification. By January 1977, ratification seemed in reach. 18 senators vowed to support ERA and 13 were against, leaving 9 senators undeclared. By April, however, a series of vote switches put ratification in doubt. When the measure failed, Wilson placed the blame on, quote, the good old boys in Southern legislatures, but she predicted they were clutching at pseudo-power that will not last. Voss concludes that the blame fell on several actors. The Florida ERA was not well organized and did not spend time debunking anti-ERA myths. But she saves her principal blame for the media, for its failure to analyze the issues or use the polling numbers to question the statements by elected officials that the people did not want the ERA. She also notes that although Senator Wilson commanded the attention of the media, journalists used her image frequently but gave her little airtime. The role of the media, Voss concludes, should be considered as a factor in the defeat of the ERA in the Florida legislature.
It's amazing that this legislation still hasn't become law. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is associate professor at the University of Central Florida, director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Coral Way Elementary in South Florida created an innovative curriculum to deal with the influx of Cuban refugees in the 1960s. Holly Baker has more.
In the 1960s, increased immigration from Cuba to Florida led to the creation of a dual language instruction curriculum at Coral Way Elementary School in Miami-Dade County. In 1963, Coral Way Elementary School became the first public school in the United States to establish a dual language immersion program. As a young child, Bess DeFarber was one of the first students to experience the bilingual education program at Coral Way Elementary School.
Coral Way is in the southwest area of Miami. It's not far from Vizcaya and the Museum District. And the school was surrounded by banyan trees and thousands of birds lived in there. And it was an Anglo school, or you would say a North American-based school, where students learned English. So in the first year, I was in first grade in 62-63. And in that year, many of the Cuban immigrants were coming to Miami. And my mother had also gotten a job at Jackson Memorial Hospital because she was bilingual. Mostly she spoke Spanish as her first language because she was from Argentina. My father also spoke Spanish fluently. And so in our home, we spoke Spanish as the first language. English was the second language.
Constructed in 1936 as part of the Works Progress Administration, Coral Way Elementary School was designed by August Geiger, a prominent South Florida architect known for his beautiful Mediterranean Revival-style designs.
The building was designed in a kind of Meisner Mediterranean Spanish-style villa, and it's kind of like in a big C shape. And in the middle, there's a beautiful courtyard. The second story, you can see exposed beams, wooden beams on the ceilings in the hallways. And the breezeways on the second floor all look out to this beautiful tropical paradise. And there was a sundial in the middle of the courtyard, and that's where we had all of our festivals. So there was this big fall festival every year, where the PTA ran it, and there were all kinds of games and cakewalk and all kinds of wonderful things that we did in that plaza area. It's just beautiful. It has the red tiled roof, but also then behind that first row are also some very beautiful homes that were built in the 30s, 40s, and later mid-century modern buildings, homes, housing. So it is just a really interesting community. And within walking distance of Coral Way, you had the Greek church. So there were lots of Greek students The Greek Orthodox Church was right next to Beth David Synagogue that was on the road, Coral Way. And then there was also the Catholic Church and a school, and that was very close to the neighborhood. So I would say it was very, very diverse.
The dual language program at Coral Way Elementary School began as an experiment following the Cuban refugee crisis. As a result of the experiment, the students became not only bilingual, but also bicultural.
Third, fourth, fifth, sixth grades were all bilingual in the same exact methodology, where everything you studied in English, in the afternoon you studied in Spanish. We were tested and tested and tested. And of course, as students, we had no idea whether this was important or why the testing was happening. There was no orientation. There was, I don't think, any orientation really for the parents either, that we were in some kind of educational experiment to see if you taught two languages to a student at a very young age, and everything was taught, all subjects were taught in both languages, how would they turn out? Would they be considered educated in the same manner in which the English-only students at other schools were being taught? And what we found from this project of building a digital collection was that our scores were better than the student scores who were only learning one language.
Besta Farber, once a student at Coral Way Elementary School, is now the grants manager at George A. Smathers Libraries at the University of Florida. She's also one of the creators of the Coral Way Digital Collection Archives at the University of Florida. The collection began at the University of Arizona Libraries through the work of renowned international scholar of bilingual education, Dr. Richard Ruiz, and transferred to the University of Florida after his death. The Coral Way Digital Collection contains historical and official documents, correspondences, photographs, memorabilia, and oral histories collected from Coral Way student alumni, teachers, and administrators. Besta Farber.
Now there's a collection of 252 objects at the University of Florida Digital Collections. It's open access. It's free to the public. Now there's more, so much more information that's been analyzed and raw material. So you can go to the University of Florida Digital Collections and just search Coral Way Elementary, and it should be right there. And you can see all of my report cards and see that I did so much better in my Spanish speaking classes or subjects and also in music.
To see the Coral Way Digital Collection at the University of Florida, go to ufdc.ufl.edu/coralway. To learn more, check out the book, The Coral Way Bilingual Program, by Dr. Maria R. Cody, an Irving and Rose Fien Endowed Professor and Associate Professor of Bilingual Education at the University of Florida. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook at Florida Historical Society. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.